Hello, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight Latino Voices. I'm Joan Hernandez. I hope everyone had a good Christmas. Here's what we're looking at. 47 years in prison, a new documentary examines one man's journey in the politics of parole. 2025 is just around the corner. We explore how different Latino cultures are ringing in the new year.
Every item has an owner.
And how a passion for collecting led to an exciting business venture. And now to some of today's top stories. The new year is bringing in some new laws, one of which is an increase in the state's minimum wage. Starting on New Year's Day, the minimum wage in Illinois will rise to $15 an hour. It marks the final increase of a six-year effort that was Governor J.B. Pritzker's first major legislative victory. Illinois workers earning minimum wage will soon see a $1 an hour bump. Additionally, tip workers will see their wages rise to $9 an hour. According to National Employment Law Project, Illinois will be one of 10 states with a minimum wage of $15 or more. To learn about other new laws coming in 2025, check out our website, wttw.com/news. Despite higher costs for groceries and other goods, holiday spending increased this year. Sales from the beginning of November through Christmas Eve climbed 3.8% according to MasterCard Spending Plus, which tracks various types of payments, including cash and debit cards. That beats the 3.1% increase from last year. The data released today excludes auto sales and is not adjusted for inflation. And Chicagoans are celebrating Kwanzaa with celebrations across the city, including this event at Malcolm X College. Organizers hosted a marketplace and a celebration that included a drum call, performances, a candle lighting, and a recounting of the holiday's history. The seven-day holiday is a celebration of African American culture. The free program at Malcolm X College begins at noon and runs through January 1st. Up next, a new documentary looks at the politics of parole.
Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
Ronnie Carrasquillo served nearly 47 years in prison before being released. In 1977, as an 18-year-old, he was convicted of killing an off-duty Chicago police officer and given a 200 to 600-year prison sentence. A new documentary, In Their Hands, highlights his journey while raising questions about mass incarceration, the parole system, and the meaning of getting a second chance. Joining us here are director and producer Dan Protes and Ronnie Carrasquillo, whose story is followed in this film. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you. I got
to watch the documentary. Ronnie, very impactful. I want to start with you. You spent, as I just said, most of your adult life in prison. Towards the end of the film, you mentioned that your sister, Janet, asked you a question. She said, what are you going to do when you get out of prison? Now, it's been over a year since you were released. How did it feel to realize you were actually home with your family?
My sister's name is Dara.
Dara, I'm sorry.
And it's a blessing to be home, to be around family members that you haven't never lived around for so long, to see the different habits of where they live, how they eat, how they speak. So it's just a blessing to be in that vicinity, in that arena, to participate with them after they spent 47 years basically in the prison system along with me, struggling with me, paying bills with me, sending money in there, just paying lawyers and hosting dinners and just building and continuously building of not only helping me, but you can't help but help other people.
I can imagine you and your sister Dara have a very, Dara have a very special bond.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Very special bond. She was, you call her go-getter. She's just a go-getter to orchestrate this and to be, we basically call it the hub. Everybody rotated around her that she, you know, call out and people will respond.
Oh, and Dan, you know, why was it important to you to follow Ronnie and his family and to make this film?
Well, so Ronnie's attorney, Jennifer Sobel, approached me with the story. And at first, I have to admit, I was not 100% certain whether I wanted to tell the story. But there were a couple of things that drew me in. One was, as Ronnie was just talking about, his family. I knew that just logistically, I'd only be able to spend so much time interviewing him in prison and capturing his life. And so you need, in any documentary, some human element that's going to draw the audience in. And I saw that his family was really compelling in the way that they stood by him for 47 years and rallied around him and fought for his freedom. And then also the parole board itself I found to be quite compelling. I'd never been to a parole hearing before I went to Ronnie's parole hearing, and found it to be an unusual process. I've spent a bunch of time in courtrooms. It's definitely not a courtroom. Prisoner Review Board members are ultimately the judges of sorts, but they're also kind of like the witnesses. They've been presented these piles of evidence from each side, from Ronnie's attorney and on the other side from the Fraternal Order of Police who were fighting his release. But ultimately, they spend a fair amount of time, I would say, pontificating about what might have happened on one night in 1976 and overlooking who Ronnie is today.
Oh, so that made you jump on board, the emotional aspect. And Ronnie, in the film, we get an inside look of the process of you being denied parole more than 30 times, but you weren't defeated by that. How did you manage to stay positive?
Well, watching my brothers, my sisters, my father, my family, just every year getting in cars and spending the money and the time, the energy to go to these hearings, and the faith that they had in the system. They believed in the system that it was going to honor what was on the law books to grant me parole. And they came to find out after so many times, after going to a prison review board over 30 times, that something's wrong there. Something's not being activated in there that they believed in. So they started exploring different channels by having meetings with attorneys and different advocates of different ways to advocate for my release.
And talking about your family, how was it like for you to look back at the film and see your family and the toll, you know, that this journey has taken on them?
It's emotional to watch that, you know, you're in the prison and you can see, you know that the hearing goes on, you know that they went there, but I actually got a chance to see what Dan captured physically and sit there and watch the video, to watch their emotions as the denials go on, of the tears and the huggings and, you know, that it's another defeat. But we just, as a family, regroup and you ready, we're going back this way. This shouldn't have happened that time and that shouldn't. So we just strategize again and again.
What does that say about your family?
My family's amazing. You know, they're amazing. They were relentless in the struggle. You know, and each one came at a different season. Sometimes one brother would put the charge on for a year, 2 years, and then still be there. But then a sister would come and put the charge on for a length. But when they called each other, they came out.
The passion there. And we also see in the film that police officers and the police union come to parole hearings every year. They are adamant that anyone who has killed a cop should never be released from prison. You know, how do you respond to that sentiment?
When I see that, they're in the law enforcement, so my understanding of that is when you first go to prison, you try to find out, how can I come out of prison? And the law that held me or any person at that time says that you're sentenced for the seriousness of your offense. I was sentenced for the seriousness of my offense. There's a part B to that that says you have to be restored to useful citizenship. And that's what gained my release in the end. We proved in the court that they were denying my right to be restored. So I believe when law enforcement or judges or military, anybody takes an office, they take an oath to uphold the Constitution of the country and of the state. And the Constitution said that I had the right to be restored. And it becomes personal when somebody says, we're going to ignore that. We're going to put that to the side, and we're going to believe you're going to die here. We're going to try to make you die here. Then there's a breach in the program. There's a breach, and it should be a red flag to the higher authority. Something has to change in there, and I hope and I pray that this document exposes this, that people can come to the table, and that the fairness and the equity that they call it, the equality of justice, actually becomes justice instead of injustices.
And, you know, talking about that, Dan, the film explores the battle between politics and law and how it played into Ronnie's case. What do you want people to take away from how the parole board handled the case?
Well, yeah, as I said earlier, they really kept coming back to what he did as a drunk 18-year-old, where he, you know, committed a reckless act, though he did not intend to kill a Chicago police officer. The evidence shows that. They kept coming back to that one action. And as Ronnie said, the Illinois State Constitution calls on us to restore offenders to useful citizenship. And that was Ronnie now is a useful citizen. I mean, he's here. He's out among us. He's a value to his family and his community. He goes from church to church and talks about his journey. We have been denying us, the citizens of Illinois, we have been denying ourselves Ronnie's presence. And he's a value to the community, and I just wish the board would have seen that earlier. And instead of continuing to return to his actions as an 18-year-old. At one point, Ronnie said that I believe you said to the board, I'm the oldest 18-year-old you've ever met, because that's how they treated him as a 65-year-old, 18-year-old.
I think your sister even mentioned, I mean, who remembers the version that we were when we were 18 years old? And Ronnie, while in prison, you became passionate about Latino unity. You share your own personal traumas and experiences growing up. You started different initiatives in prison. What made you want to make that change?
I felt that we were there. We couldn't keep continually doing this to ourselves, that we had to return to our families better people. We had to live with each other. So if we can live with each other in that environment, we can spread that word to our communities. So we reached out through a cultural committee that we started, Hispanic Cultural Committee. It was a Max Serta, and there was eventually a parole board member, a prison review board member. And we sat down and negotiated how to bring the schools from our community, from Humboldt Park, into the prison. And we requested the wardens and everybody. They allowed us to do it. And it stopped a lot of violence. It was where once upon a time you didn't speak to each other. And then you speak to each other. And in the end, basically many enemies that you would say in street gang life that I had were there to ask for my liberty.
Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing your story, Ronnie. And thank you, Dan, for filming it.
Thank you.
And you can watch In Their Hands tomorrow night at 9 on WTTW. Up next, a look at Latino celebrations of the new year. Stay with us. With less than a week until New Year's Eve, people are planning how to step into 2025 with their best foot forward. In Latino cultures, that could mean practicing age-old traditions like eating 12 grapes, wearing white, and cleaning your house. All for good luck, of course. Now, we contacted some locals to see how they're ringing in the new year. Joining us here are Margarita Vasquez, founder of The Marinated Kitchen, Xiomara Casas, owner of Mi Corazon Cafe in Pilsen, and Maria Durrell from the Brazilian Culture Center of Chicago. Thank you, ladies, for being here. Now, there are a lot of superstitions, which is so funny because I think, like, every culture has some. Maria, I want to start with you. You know, what are some superstitions you heard growing up in Brazil, and how do you believe in these stories?
some of these stories were passed down through generations, through in the community, your grandmother, and your family.
What are some of the superstitions that you would say that you follow?
So some of the superstitions, they were brought in with immigrants, some are from the African culture. And for example, one that everybody does it, which actually is a reference to Afro-Brazilian culture and heritage, is wearing white.
Wearing white.
Because it doesn't matter which religion or community you come from, when it comes to white, everybody wears, it's for peace and also means a renewal. So that's one of them. Second one, we have the grapes. You eat the 12 grapes.
I think a lot of people eat the grapes, right?
Yeah.
For good
luck. I
think one that I found interesting was eating lentils.
We do eat lentils that come from the Italian community. The grapes come from other communities as well. And then we have the one that comes from the Greek community in Brazil is eating pomegranate.
Wow.
And it's saving some seeds, like 7 seeds you put in your wallet and you carry with you for the whole year. So it's time.
Without getting lost, I think I would lose the pomegranate seeds.
No, you're just making sure that they're zipped.
Margarita, how about you? What are some superstitions that you say that you do to ring in the new year?
So in my household, my mom, it was always like, we have to clean up, clean up. I was like, Mommy, why are we going to clean? People are coming over. It's New Year's Eve. No, the house needs to be clean. So it's like starting at a clean slate. Everything needs to be clean. So this way you're starting the New Year's at a clean slate, you know? And that was pretty much one of them. Yes.
How about you, Samara?
For my family, it would be eating the 12 grapes, but extra measure would be under the table.
Okay, I have not done that under the table.
Yeah, you're supposed to eat the 12 grapes at midnight under the table, and it's supposed to bring you, like, new love.
I love that. I love what all these things mean. And Margarita, as we know, so much of the holiday season is celebrated with food and drinks, and you brought a little something, which is coquito, very Puerto Rican traditional drink. Tell me what's inside.
So the coquito, in my household, my husband makes the coquito, but this year I took a chance. So the coquito has coconut cream, coconut milk, evaporated milk and condensed milk and some spices. So it's best to let it sit for 2 days, and it's meant as a little cocktail drink, not a big cup, because once you have coquito, I tell you, you
because
might go loquito.
Right?
Yes.
It has rum. We can't forget it has rum.
It has rum. Mm-hmm. So it's a traditional drink that we have. It's kind of like an eggnog, but it's a Puerto Rican style, and this does not have eggs. So everyone makes it different. It's the tradition of what your family, the recipe they shared.
Yeah. I think in Mexican culture, because I believe in Mexican as well, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's the ponche for us, which is like this hot punch. And, you know, for you, you know, what traditions are you look forward to practicing? I think you had mentioned that, you know, you would celebrate New Year's Eve for your grandma's birthday.
My grandmother, yeah. Her birthday was the 31st. But yeah, she passed away. So every year for her birthday, we'd get together as a family, cut a cake, sing for her. Yeah, and just celebrate her.
What is it going to look like this year?
This year, we might visit her at the cemetery. You know, we still get together as a family. She's very missed, but, you know, it brings us together either way, and we get to remember her.
Do you feel like you also honor that in your cafe?
In my cafe, I opened in honor of my grandmother. Everything was in honor of her. If I wasn't close to my grandmother as I grew up, I wouldn't be as in touch with my culture. You see pictures of her in the cafe, drinks, the food is all inspired by her, the decorations as well. It's all thanks to my grandma.
I've gone to your cafe. I love how colorful
it
looks like. And Maria, the ideal of renewal and starting over is big in Afro-Brazilian culture. How do you teach the younger generation about these new beginnings?
One of the things that we do, actually, like if you are in Brazil, we, as a family, you go to the ocean, especially the lake, and we have jumping over the waves.
Wow.
So we have the 7 times as a way of renewal, and also you ask for, you ask the news for prosperity and healthy for the new year.
I didn't know
so
that. That looks really cool.
Everybody jumps together, all the family, you hold hands with families and friends, and then you jump over the waves 7 times.
Oh,
so everybody's on the shore. So there'll be like millions of people. We also have the celebration of the flowers that we put the flower in the ocean for Iemanjá, that the jar.
That sounds really beautiful.
Yeah, so there are several ways that we celebrate. And because Brazil is such an immigrant country, a country of immigrants, so we draw so many different types of customs from different countries.
The jumping is so interesting. Have you seen people do it here in Chicago?
Here in Chicago, there is a space where we go for the flowers. Because at the end of the year, before midnight, you have to put flowers for Yemaja, which is the god of the sea. But since it's not the sea, we put it in the lake. And then everyone as a group will bring it flowers to the lake and then put it for a good year, for the renewal.
That sounds really special. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Margarita, you founded your business, The Marinated Kitchen, in 2020. Why was it important for you to create a space that preserves Puerto Rican recipes?
So for me, I started The Marinated Kitchen because I wanted to create a legacy for my family and just to keep the tradition, you know, of cooking with sofrito and garlic paste. So that's one of my brands. I was going to bring some, but I didn't have any, so I bought coquito.
It was sold out.
It was sold out, which is good. And I just wanted to keep the tradition of, you know, how do we cook? You start with your caldero, which is my mom's, pot, and just to show them how to cook and what do you need to add into the rice to give it flavor, because in the Puerto Rican culture, you need good food that tastes, you know, really good season with a lot of sofrito, garlic, with the sazon, and
the sofrito is very important.
It's important. If there's no sofrito, it's like, oh, I can't cook. No hay sofrito. Go get sofrito. And then just to keep those traditions so that everyone in the family could just be united and keep my mom's legacy alive. And also, too, I wanted to just keep the family together because as tradition continues, I noticed, you know, we start separating because no one wants to continue with the cooking. There's a lot of work. Who's going to host? And just keeping the family together. So that was one of the themes, basically to create a legacy for my family.
I love that.
And keep the recipes alive.
Alive. Well, thank you all for sharing your traditions. It's so beautiful. And I can't even believe the new year is, a week away? Yeah. So I guess happy new year. Thank you, ladies.
No, thank you.
Up next, exploring the curated collections and hidden gems at a local antique shop. Chicago is filled with hidden gems. We recently visited an antique shop in Pilsen, taking customers back in time. Here's another look.
If you're walking down 18th Street, it's hard to pass this storefront without wondering what's inside. As soon as you step in, you realize it's just about everything.
People found it like magical, and as soon as people, they just get in, the sense start on smelling the, you know, the bakery and touching the items and go all around the store.
Francisco Orozco is the owner of El Anticuario, retro, weird stuff, cool junk. He says his passion for collecting began when he was just a kid in Mexico.
I like to swim, and I found a little piece of metal under the water. And since then, it was a very interesting piece. And since then, I mean, I started.
Quirky vintage items, gadgets, and a collection of Latin American books, statues, and artifacts are found throughout the antique shop.
This is the best part of the store because we tried to find the rarest books in whole Chicago.
And if you hang around long enough, it'll start to feel like you've entered a whole other world.
This is very representative of our culture, the bad and the good. And you can see in the back, there is six bottles, originals. Okay. It's like a gift from a person. God made a miracle and they offer it to the Lord. And this is in a very antique and old tradition.
Orozco opened the shop 6 years ago and runs it with his wife Alex and his daughter Gibby.
We used to call it hoarding because it very much is hoarding. Their house, oh my gosh, growing up. We would go to school, and just what he does here, he would do at home. So we'd come home, all the furniture rearranged.
Gibby says the more unusual the discovery, the better it is.
This one right here, it's a doctor trying to keep death away from taking the woman. So many people have asked about this one, and so many people have offered, but we're like, no, it's just a rare find.
Orozco says the shop is a representation of his roots. He wants it to be a space to celebrate his culture and love for all things strange.
And I always say to the people that This is not a place, it's more like a concert.
Everything in the store is intentionally curated.
Nothing here is new. I mean, everything is, we're trying to bring.
But like you said, everything that you have here has a story.
Right, right. And I believe every item has, I don't know how to say it, but it's like a calling, a person, is what I'm being found. So every item has an owner.
Gibby credits her parents for the success of the antique shop in the community.
It's not just another store to them. It's like them opening their home.
Yeah, I mean, they can come here and have an experience.
Great place to explore. The family recently opened a second location across the street. There you can find furniture, a large collection of paintings, and decor. And if you visit on the weekend, Francisco's wife sells baked goods. Now, that's our show for this Thursday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 7 for a special edition of the Weekend Review, where we look at the biggest stories from 2024. Now, from all of us here in Chicago tonight, I'm Joanna Hernandez. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe. Buenas noches.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, wishing all a happy and healthy holiday season.